Rewind the dynamite from the post-wrestling site. AEW, lighting up the fuse. Sit back and enjoy the bubbly. As we hear from John and Waitin. Where we're going, we don't need roads. And if the buck stops here, this thing might blow. Everything you hear, opinions of the show. And if you don't like it, go to the forums and let them know.
And we are live with Rewind to Dynamite, coming just moments after the big edition of the show from Manchester, New Hampshire.
That is correct. Yeah.
The center of the wrestling universe, Manchester, New Hampshire. Man, where was this crowd on fire from start to finish?
I didn't even know there was a Manchester in New Hampshire, actually.
Well, neither did these people. I don't want to be too hard, but there was an interesting episode. Was it like, Dynamite.
So you thought it was a really bad crowd?
They livened up for Hobbs at the end. I would say Hobbs and Ospreay, they certainly got into at the end. But it was, I think this is like the usual AEW audience that we tend to get. Like, these hot crowds are much more infrequent than the norm. So it's kind of just, it's static. But there was a lot of stuff on this show that I felt, there was some really great stuff that, in front of a livelier crowd, I think would feel a lot more hotter. And for a lot of this show, to me, it felt like just a very cold product, just in terms of it not really resonating with a crowd. And I think it just brought that down for me in particular points of the show. But you did get the big surprise at the end, not just with Hobbs, but with Will Ospreay. And I think that really did activate this crowd for that big overrun.
Yeah, for me, I guess... I didn't even maybe note so much about the crowd, because I don't think it's such a unique aspect of like these shows anymore. This felt like kind of a typical edition of Dynamite. You know, if they felt smaller, I would only assume that was probably because of the numbers and in the maybe size of the building more than I would say quality of the show.
Well, it's interesting because you and I, neither of us have watched the NXT show, but I would venture to guess there were probably 1,000 people in that building, and I have no doubt what the hotter sounding atmosphere was going to be without having to watch a minute of the NXT show.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen clips of it on Twitter, and it sounded great. It's the ECW arena, it packed full of people for a lot of nostalgia. So, yeah, now is... I guess it, to me, a question is like, how much of that is affecting the average viewer's perception of AEW? Like, is that stopping somebody from watching a Dynamite, or is it just something that they're not noticing, or at least they don't mind?
What is not connecting with the young male voter, wrestling fan? That's the question on everyone's mind. Is it connecting? Is it a message that is being delivered to that 18 to 34 year old demographic? We're outside of it. We can't answer. But Wei, it's glad to see you. You are back. How was your extremely quick vacation?
It was really nice. Yeah, got to go to a place called Great Wolf Lodge, which evidently is a chain. I thought this was like exclusive to Niagara Falls, but no, they have these everywhere, evidently. Just a nice little indoor water park, you know. Now that we have a kid, I guess there are a lot of these things that like are a lot more fun, you know, rather than I guess like I probably wouldn't ever just do it on my own, for instance. So we took our 2-year-old, and it's not like he could take advantage of so many of the rides, but like there was enough for him to do, and just simply being in a place where like we could let him run around and feel safe about it. It's a lot of work, as always. I wouldn't say it was so much of a vacation as much as it was maybe like full-time daycare that we were now leading. But at the end, you only remember the smiles, and it's totally worth it.
Well, that's nice to hear. How was the food?
It was good. Yeah. I don't love buffets, dude. Like, they're just...
It's satisfactory, right?
It's fine. They're fine. Okay. But like, I recognize that I think I really like an expert to curate my meal rather than just having like a bunch of individual things and just like...
You got to do the work.
Yeah, like, I mean, I end up just, like, forgetting about it all. It just becomes, and you eat way too much. You know, I don't think they're great.
Okay, so thumbs down, very, very clearly.
It was a good but decent buffet, yeah.
It's satisfactory. Well, I'm glad you had a good time.
Thanks, man. And you had a great show with Nate. Thank you very much to Mr. Milton for pulling double duty over the weekend.
Man, he was a very busy man. He was doing something like five shows in 2 days and squeezed us in on Monday night. I would not have asked him if it was a three-hour Raw, but I felt okay to ask him for the two-hour version.
Oh, man. I can listen to that dude forever, maybe even 5 hours a month, which I do every single month. So, yeah, more Nate is always a good thing.
Well, you got five shows of him this week, so you can catch all of it. Nate, always great to chat up with Nate. And the NWA podcast will be back later this month, November 17th. So circle that on your calendars for Sunday when we will get the whole crew back together. But on today's show, we are going to go through Dynamite. Also, at this time, Braden and Davey are live going through that NXT episode. So after you listen to this, you can download Up Next, or you can do your... you can't really do picture-in-picture. We can't do, like, ear-in-ear, but best to try and not watch both at the same time.
Yeah, maybe we can do picture-in-picture, actually. Let me just see if I can try this, actually.
Okay, we're about to get screw up our connection.
Copyright
here.
Flagged for our own show. Oh, I got to sit through the ads. Sorry.
Well, they are busy at work and probably breaking down Nunzio in 2024.
I did not expect that, did you?
A bunch of cameos.
A Nunzio match? Look at this. Inception.
Yeah. It's so look at this. He even busted out his Kimona shirt for the for the occasion. And Davey with his McFoley flannel. So
yes.
There you go. What is happening over on the other channel? This is where we read out the spoilers, because this is a taped episode. It's like that'll put butts in seats. All right. Well, there you have it. This is jarring for me to be talking and I'm seeing them, but I can't hear them. So anyway, let us talk about some of the news that is going on. And this is a remarkable story that I don't think is, I mean, it's getting coverage, but it feels as though it should be getting a whole lot more.
Not today. It's not going to get that many headlines today is what I'm saying.
Well, I'm talking about the Conor McGregor trial that has begun this week. And
yeah, that's what I'm talking about
even like it's. Anyway, a lot of this reporting is coming from Paul Healy at the Irish Mirror, who has been in the courthouse reporting directly. And for those that are not familiar, because there has been a litany of stuff surrounding Conor McGregor for a number of years, there was an allegation from December of 2018 from a woman who had claimed that she was raped by McGregor and another friend of Conor's. And what happened was that she was informed that they were not going to be pursuing a criminal case. So instead, a civil suit was filed, and that's what has begun this week. So this is a civil case. He is not facing jail time, but he is accused of luring this woman, who admits she was heavily intoxicated and had also consumed cocaine that evening, that he had posted on her Instagram, and then she messaged him, and they met at this party. Then they left, and she was of the belief they were going to another party, ends up going to this friend's home, and it's her and her own friend, and ends up where she gets raped and gets into... Today, she was on the stand, and she was also cross-examined, but stated that she was pinned down and suffered bruises, scratches from the encounter, and ended up, it was both individuals that allegedly had sex with her. She claimed that she was grabbed by the throat by McGregor, and at a certain point, like, this is a professional fighter grabbing you by the throat. She was in fear of her life here, said her only defense was to bite him. Now, what's also worth noting in this case is that there are several contemporaneous witnesses that she informed about at this time. Number one was a friend of hers who she texted the next day and exchanged photos of the markings on her. She did tell the friend to delete those photos, stating she was not going to be pressing charges. She would not disclose who this was with. But there were text messages between the two going over this, and those were shown in court. There was also the victim's mother, who took her to the hospital the next day, and a gynecologist who has also testified about there being multiple bruises, that she was shaking, she was crying as they conducted a rape exam and going over all the different injuries and such. So that's where things stand at the moment. And today she was cross-examined, and this had been reported way back by the New York Times, but they, you know, in Ireland, they have very sensitive laws when it comes to, you know, cases of sexual assault and releasing the name of who is accused and such. But this has all since come out this week, where this was just going to be a civil case, and we didn't even know the particulars of this case. And to add to this, in a civil case, the standard of proof is a balance of probabilities rather than a criminal case where you have to prove beyond reasonable doubt. So this is a jury trial, and it's expected to go on for 2 weeks. But those are the notes from the first 2 days. Like, the details are extremely grim, and it gets very, very gruesome of what is alleged at this point in time. But it's certainly, I mean, just from the details, you know, you have, you know, multiple people that are testifying that they were alerted of this at the time. She tried to press criminal charges, but they stated that they felt that there would not be enough evidence to pursue the charges, and that's why they did not move forward with a criminal case, and thus we have this civil case.
Have there been any other instances of this sort of accusation against Conor McGregor in the past?
I mean, honestly, I don't want to even like mix up stories, because if you go to his Wikipedia and you want to look at the amount of stories that have come up about Conor McGregor, like they are, I mean, you had the one woman who had made an accusation that she ended up jumping off a boat. Do you remember this one, where the Coast Guard had to come save her because she was on a boat with Conor McGregor? I mean, you could probably go through many different issues that he has had. But this is, you know, the one that has actually made its way to a jury trial, and it becomes a question of, if he is found guilty in a civil case, you know, there's nothing. This is not a criminal verdict, but it is a civil one of what he is accused of, and how that is going to impact, you know, his reputation and his standing. Like, will people want to see this guy competing, or is this just, it's Conor McGregor, and that there?
Yeah, I would say the answer to that is probably yes.
Probably yes. I mean, yeah. That's like, in theory, there would be nothing criminally against him that would prevent him from fighting. But in the court of public opinion, it's pretty galling what is accused here. And it's one that, I mean, just to see this, to imagine this guy being promoted for a fight in a couple of months. Again, this has to play itself out, but it reads extremely dark. And it's like the victim who was on the stand, like, she literally was breaking down in just, like, crying and needed breaks to, like, relive this and such. And you can imagine what kind of comments she is getting as well, because this is so public, and there are a lot of Conor McGregor defenders out there. And this entire culture, of course, of just doubting victims that she is coming forward with. This is the first time we have a name and a face attached to this story that has kind of been lingering for a number of years. But I do encourage people to follow, especially the Irish Mirror. Paul Healy has been tweeting out, like, just really excellent coverage of this case as it continues to go on. today was the TKO third quarter earnings report, and I'm not going to go through all of this because we are doing a special Pollock and Thurston on Thursday. Brandon and I will do a more thorough breakdown, but revenue from the quarter was up 52% from the same quarter last year at $681.2 million for the quarter. WWE saw a huge increase of $51.6 million in additional revenue they generated this quarter, while UFC was down because they had one less numbered pay-per-view and also two fewer Fight Night specials in this third quarter. Some of the highlights of the quarter did include SummerSlam that they were talking about, just the huge money that that grossed. You wouldn't be... You might be shocked, but Mark Shapiro, very happy about the fact that they managed three in-ring sponsorships during SummerSlam and the broadcast. They got the three. Yeah, that was a big milestone for them.
Only three?
Well, yeah.
Come on, do better.
Plus other partners. Well, you have things to aspire to, right?
Let's go for five.
You know, we have a big quarter coming up. For the UFC, I mean, it was interesting to hear how they described UFC 306 at Sphere. That this was, they didn't give out actual figures, but just that this was an absolutely expensive show, but it was also their highest grossing one. And Mark Shapiro really doubled down on several facts. Number one was that they're never running this Sphere again. However, he did leave the door open that a Sphere is going to be opening in Abu Dhabi. They would be open to talking about that because Abu Dhabi would probably pay them a ton to do a show there. So he's open to doing that.
What if Saudi Arabia paid for this again?
They were very happy to have a title sponsor. That was a huge aspect to the success of this show. They love the idea of more title sponsors, especially if it's Riyadh season, but they pretty much said there's no chance we're doing this again. Like, this was a crazy expensive show for them to stage. Also, when he was asked about Dana White about a month ago, stating he was diving headfirst into boxing, Mark Shapiro, as polite as he could, said, well, Dana says a lot of things, and that is not attached to anything. You know, if we did boxing, it would be great. But we basically, they're stating after this recent acquisition of some of Endeavor's properties like IMG and On Location and PBR, they're like, we are not buying any more assets. There's no mergers or acquisitions coming. And they pretty much just put, basically boxing was put on the back burner here. But I know Wei, as he has become a bit of a standout on this show, I can't really do Mark Shapiro justice. So here is a quick summation of the quarter from, our favorite TKO executive here, and breaking us down and tell us in your own language how this quarter went.
You know, you can just expect more margin accretion, you know, as we flow through. I'd like to remind folks, you know, we're still in at least mid innings, if not early innings, on the integration of these two assets of WWE and UFC. I mean, we're of course already guiding to the fact that we'll beat our net cost synergies of $100 million. But as we succeed with our strategy of having these events on the same week or same weekend or subsequent weekends, now with PBR as well, our margins are only going to be better because we're going to save on that cost side. I mean, we'll sell triple header sponsorships, as we like to call them. Somebody that comes in and sponsors all three events, that'll be huge for us and it'll drive local ad sales.
Cost accretion, margins.
Did I hear margin increasion?
No, you heard cost decretion.
Oh, cost decretion.
Which I'm pretty sure is not a word. Decretion.
Cost accretion, net cost synergies. I particularly love the way he said subsequent. Subsequent? Is that a special marketing type of way you pronounce that word?
Listen, no one is ever going to top Nick Khan on these. Nick Khan was the best on these calls, but Mark Shapiro, his enthusiasm is very contagious. I mean, you never hear someone just so happy.
This is an NXT.
So much money.
This is an NXT character.
This is what Robert Stone should have been.
Sure. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So there you go. The cost accretion led to very healthy margins in Q3. Much more on this coming on Pollock and Thurston special Thursday edition at 1 p.m. Eastern time. We're going to go over the Q3 earnings, the call, the Q&A that followed. We're also going to have a guest that is a reporter over in the Middle East that attended the WWE shows in Saudi Arabia. So it'll be interesting to hear a reporter's perspective being at those shows in Saudi Arabia. We're also going to spend some time talking about the Observer Hall of Fame ballot, which is due in a couple of days. So we'll talk about that Thursday, 1 Eastern. WrestlingObserver.com reported that Michael Hayes and Bruce Pritchard are both on temporary leave. This coming from multiple sources in the company. The Observer writes that both are expected back, although the time frame was said to be indefinite. Pritchard's absence is officially said to be due to a family emergency. Hayes' absence is due to personal reasons. While both absences have taken place at the same time, there is no actual connection between the two, and those in WWE emphasize that this is not the old guard being moved out, as people would speculate, and that both will be back. So, sounds like private reasons that both are dealing with, but two very significant figures behind the scenes that are on leave. So we will continue to monitor that. Wrestle Kingdom. We have now got multiple match announcements for January 4th and a few for January 5th. So let us look at what is coming up at the Tokyo Dome. The first night, they are in fact in a headline with Zack Sabre Jr. and Shota Umino for the IWGP World Heavyweight Championship. The winner will face Ricochet on the second night. They are going full bore with Shota Umino in a very high placement. What do you think about the Shota Umino experiment?
I guess when we heard about Naito, the options weren't that many for a headliner at the Tokyo Dome that could replace somebody on his star power level, unless you're going to go outside of the company. But really, how productive is that going to be for the long term? You know, I like the move. I think you want to showcase your next generation on a big, big stage. And something like this might indicate to me that there's a higher likelihood of an actual title change. And having Shota Umino at the end of that show holding the championship high, I think would be a good signifier to the world that, hey, like, we've got a new somebody that we want to, you know, eventually be an ace in this company. But that said, I guess, did they say, like, Ricochet will be getting the championship match on the next night, or is it specific?
They full out announced Zack Sabre Jr. versus Ricochet for January 5th.
So now if Zack loses the title, does Ricochet still face Zack, or does Ricochet face Shota Umino?
I mean, kind of makes no sense for Ricochet to lose his title shot.
Yeah, it wouldn't. I mean, Zack versus Ricochet is the more attractive match.
The thing is that Umino is, it's kind of like you've booked yourself in a corner where, first of all, like, I know all the criticisms of Umino. Is this guy ready? He's not for this big of a slot. Mm-hmm. I think from New Japan's perspective, it is that, hey, we're putting all of our eggs into this basket, and we're going to see if this guy rises to the occasion. And, like, this is you're looking at this, and you certainly have that potential visual of Umino, Yota Tsuji, and either Ren Narita or Ryohei Oiwa in the TV title situation, like three of your big stars of the future as champions coming out of this show.
And do you want to go through the rest of the card first?
Yeah, let's talk about that. So beyond Zack and Umino, it is David Finlay and Yota Tsuji for the global heavyweight title, Doki and El Desperado for the junior heavyweight title, a triple threat with Ren Narita, Jeff Cobb, and Ryohei Oiwa for the television title, and then a four-way, which we had gone over on Monday, Kushida and Kevin Knight against Catch 2-2, Kosei Fujin and Robbie Eagles, and Drilla Maloney and Clark Connors for the junior heavyweight tag titles, along with the previously announced Evil Hiroshi Tanahashi match. So in this lineup, like, you do have Umino, Tsuji, Narita, and Oiwa all in prominent to semi-prominent matches in champion matches. With Umino, I think there's going to be the side of people that look at this as almost a lame duck match, in that Zack and Ricochet is the big spotlight match, at least at this point, for many people. And Umino is either going to take that away from you, or you're kind of like putting Umino in the spot where he's going to fall to Zack Sabre Jr. He needs to have an incredible performance, But to me, it tells me New Japan is looking at years down the road and willing to sacrifice almost a, like this is going to be a very, very tough sell. Because I don't see this January 4th show getting propped up by much more unless they have something up their sleeve. Because I think all the your Kenny Omega involvement, like that's all going to be saved for night two is what it sounds
right.
like.
Yeah, yeah. Unless we... Yeah, because we're going to get Tanahashi versus Evil. So, yeah.
Could we get Kazuchika Okada against Masahiro Chono on one of these nights?
I think Chono had his last retirement comeback with the Muda match. I don't think that's happening. Do we completely write out the idea of an Okada making an appearance? I don't know. But this card certainly feels like it needs something, you know, like that extra thing to grab people's attention. Now, like if in the end they're trying to sell, a New Japan World subscription, they're getting people's subscription for the fifth show. You know, if you're looking
it's not an international audience. It's like on from that worldwide perspective, right? It's like if you're mainly locked in for the fifth, it's like you're probably going to check out the fourth. I guess it's selling. It's the live event perspective that I think night one is going to be a much tougher sell for people if night two is in the event you have Kenny Omega that seems to be all things are lining up for. You've got the Bucks on that show. And whatever else is going to be added to that show. But as a combination, is this inspiring your interest for as these cards are starting to shape up?
I'm really interested in Wrestle Dynasty, you know, or Dynasty, as Chris Charlton likes to pronounce it. Maybe that's how we should be pronouncing it now, Wrestle Dynasty. I'm interested to see what a Forbidden Door concept looks like produced by New Japan inside the Tokyo Dome. I think there's still a lot of dream matches that are available with this, like, I think constantly evolving AEW roster and, like, what feels like a really fresh New Japan roster. But for the fourth, I'm interested to see what a rebuilding show looks like for New Japan Pro Wrestling, who they put at the in the closing visual, you know, to continue to signify that, hey, this is a new generation, a new era.
And also, I'll alert people to go over to postwrestling.com. I did write stories today about Al DeRusha, who just passed away, just shy of his 89th birthday, a longtime director and producer at the AWA, someone that was in the Minnesota Broadcasting Hall of Fame. And passed away, briefly worked in the WWF. But his, this guy was a very successful director in Minnesota at the station that the AWA eventually launched on. And he did all different types of Minnesota sports. He did children's programming. He directed Romper Room. I mean, he was very heavily involved in a ton of programming throughout his career. And also a story on Hiromitsu Miura, who is a former fought for Pancrase, fought for WEC, once challenged Carlos Condit. He passed away due to leukemia 2 weeks ago. So there's a story on him as well. And we've got our rating stories as well for Raw and Collision that you can check out. Postwrestling.com. And you can always go to postwrestlingcafe.com. Coming up, we will have Rewind to SmackDown on Friday, Collision Course on Saturday. And most of all, we have our great sponsors to thank. This month on the Post Wrestling Cafe, we are bringing you two editions of Rewind Away, starting off with a film review of Death Warrior. As described, the 2009 classic features five of the best mixed martial arts champions from around the world forced to play a deadly game. Plus, we tackle TNA's Turning Point from 2009. Karen Peterson and Bruce Lord will be covering the historic Crossover 2 event, plus an Ask Away mailbag show, Rewind to SmackDown, and Collision Course. $6 a month gets you access to the Post Wrestling Cafe.
Right about now is probably when many of you are stressing about those end-of-year travel plans. Don't make things tougher for yourself by waiting till the last minute to consider data options for your phone. Hunting for SIM cards at the airport is time-consuming, while roaming fees from your home provider can be expensive. There's a much better option for international data these days, and that's with an eSIM service like Saily. Saily provides mobile data in 160 countries at affordable prices. It's easy to install, and you could do it right from home. Just download the app on your eSIM-enabled phone, pick a data plan that suits your needs, and follow the steps to install. No more swapping SIM cards or worrying about surprise charges. Saily plans come with 24/7 chat support if you run into any issues. Plus, since it's created from the team behind NordVPN, you can feel secure about your connection. To get an exclusive 15% off your Saley purchase, go to saley.com/postwrestling or download the Saley app and use code postwrestling at checkout. The link is in the description of this podcast. Stay connected and travel smart this holiday season with Saley.
And that's what people would have been downloading if they had made the trip to Manchester, New Hampshire on Wednesday night for Dynamite in front of 2,647 per WrestleTix. Starting off the show, Way, it's the Hurt Syndicate coming out in their suits with Tony Schiavone. MVP was one of the most over guys on this show, and MVP just leaned into it. It's like, let the chance ride out. And he kicks out Tony from the ring, puts over the accolades of Shelton Benjamin and Bobby Lashley. You learn something new every time you tune into a pro wrestling program. On this broadcast, I learned that Bobby Lashley was an undefeated 19-0 MMA fighter, which is wild because I distinctly remember watching one of the worst heavyweight fights in history between Bobby Lashley and his opponent that night, Chad Griggs, where one Chad Griggs prevailed. Bobby Lashley, 15-2 record, which I guess could be construed as 19-0 if you were... I don't know how you would get to there, but I guess some of these losses were disputed by MVP.
I'm very curious how he, because 15-2 sounds plenty impressive. Now how did he get to 19?
He not only erased the losses, but then he piled on 4 extra wins.
Are we talking about did he have amateur or at least like
not MMA fights? He didn't do any amateur MMA fights.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. That's an interesting question. Yeah. Well, maybe the wrestling character of Bobby Lashley has a 19-0 MMA record.
Okay. He explains the power of a Hurt Syndicate business card. It can change your life, but if you reject it, this is what happens. And they showed the beatdown of Swerve last week. And Swerve comes out with a chain, and Prince Nana, out with his coffee, challenges Bobby Lashley with two words, full gear. Mm-hmm. And MVP accepts, and we got a match for full gear.
Yeah, Swerve, I guess, was so pissed off about the beatdown that he suddenly forgot how to speak. And he came out here like kind of like the Incredible Hulk, you know, like just like speaking, like looking angry, grunting, holding a chain and just saying the words, Bobby Lashley, full gear. You know, I get the sense the crowd might have been expecting a bit more of a promo, you know, but I think that's what they were going for. For me, I think I might have preferred a bit more of a promo than maybe what he was attempting here. I wonder if the chain is supposed to indicate any sort of stipulation that might be attached to a match, or maybe it's just his choice of weapon right now.
Maybe they're going to chain wrestle.
Sure. I think this Hurt Syndicate has been very well introduced. I mean, starting off with Shelton's introduction, which I don't think could have gone better. You know, they made Shelton feel like a refreshed and significant threat on his own. And when you pile a Bobby Lashley on top of it, it makes Lashley feel bigger, knowing that the second in the stable is already like at such a high level. And MVP, his promos are always at a very high, consistent level. And seeing the group formed on AEW just kind of makes you realize how much we've missed them and how underutilized they've been in the WWE over the past several years without being given like a proper send-off. So very happy this group is in AEW. I think they'll flourish.
On to the first match of the show. It's Claudio Castagnoli and Pac against Darby Allin and Orange Cassidy. And Cassidy and
Pac. We have an official name for the stable. They are the Death Riders. They have new music. So that's it.
I wasn't quite sure if that was the new name because Excalibur only referred to them as the Death Riders about 58 times.
Well, listen, they're trying to, you know, sell a new IP, sell some t-shirts. All right.
So Cassidy is out by himself. So Castagnoli and Pac come to approach him at the entrance when Darby appears on the tunnel and leaps off, and they have a brawl on the floor until they beat down Cassidy in the ring, get the heat on him. Big hot tag to Darby, who coffin drops his way onto Pac on the floor. And then his momentum is stopped. Pac hit the first of, I want to say, 6 brainbusters I saw on this show on the mat off the top to Darby. And then Cassidy is in for that save. And then we got some cool double team stuff from Cassidy and Darby, including a stun dog to Claudio to set up a code red. And then we get Tope Suicidas from both of the baby faces. Yuta comes in. He's struck by an orange punch. Then Claudio eats one. Marina Shafir, just as seen enough, jumps into the ring, attacks Bryce Remsburg as Moxley puts a choke onto Cassidy, and Darby gets his skateboard out, and the match is thrown out in 13 minutes and 32 seconds. Darby continues to fight off Yuta and Pac using the skateboard, finally runs into a European uppercut from Claudio, and Claudio lifts Darby and presses him overhead into the post at about 40 miles an hour, it felt like, and Orange gets stomped down, and out come the conglomeration to make the save and check on Orange Cassidy.
And this sets up a trio's title defense for a collision between the conglomeration and the Death Riders.
Yes. Yeah. So that is we have two matches announced for collision. Yes. The trio's title match being one of them, which we would see the conglomeration would get at least a win on this show. So there was a logical reason to set this up.
I thought this tag match was turning out really well. Pac and Claudio are an amazing heel tag team. They continue this like BCC style of just being like ultra aggressive, so dominant, yet like so like completely technical but vicious at the same time. And it set up some great comebacks from Darby Allin and Orange Cassidy. So as a tag team match, I thought this was a really high quality match, of course, up until the finish, you know, where it feels like more and more frequent that like AEW is doing these sort of like DQ or like, you know, just kind of like, these types of finishes that I ultimately don't mind so much, especially for TV, you know, especially if they're used to like further a program. But it's just, it is going away, I guess, a little from maybe what the company has kind of made a name for not doing finishes like these for so many of its earlier years. Overall, I really like the way that they're continuing to present these Death Riders. You know, they look like an impossible-to-beat threat that you really do want to see your favorite baby faces try to take down.
You see a skateboard. That might be their downfall.
Those things are hard, man. You ever try skateboarding? I'm curious.
I had a skateboard when I was a kid. I wasn't very good. Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah. Your kid's really into skateboarding now, right?
A bit, yeah. Yeah, he's done lessons and such, so he's probably more proficient at it than me.
Don't show him any Darby Allin videos.
No, probably. I'll wait on that one.
Ronnie Mullen, show him that.
Did you catch the name of the tour of all these November shows that they're promoting?
Oh, I missed the name itself. What are they calling it?
This is November to Remember.
Oh, interesting. Okay, well.
Very interesting. That is a naming convention that they are able to use. And that is not going to be an NXT special.
That is interesting. I mean, I would have suggested today's show at the 2300 Arena, you know, would have been called that. But
maybe they're not allowed to use it. Maybe this has to be something. They're not just doing this if it was not in the clear. Like this had to be one of those like lapsed trademarks that they could use.
Interesting. So. Interesting. All right.
But I did not see them using this prior to tonight. So anyway. Renee, who actually posted, she was on crutches for whatever reason. She had some injury, but was in between her segments, wow, was like on crutches tonight. So didn't show it on TV. She was you wouldn't have known this if she hadn't disclosed this. And
Death Rider, Renee Young,
Renee perhaps Paquette, yeah, maybe maybe Adam Cole and her had similar injuries.
Yeah, sure. Got to watch out for those ramps.
She asks Ricochet about his surprise partner tonight, but he's got to keep it a secret. The Hurt Syndicate walk up, and they just look at him, and they wish him good luck. They compliment him on his suit. He's like, okay, nice to see you again, Bobby. Watch me work. I'm like, okay. Okay.
There's not much. This wasn't a very good segment to recap because it was so low on dialogue, but very heavy on the intimidation. I like it, you know. Like I think so often we in wrestling with these sort of backstage segments, we get stuck in these patterns. I thought it was refreshing to see a segment without much talking at all. Just a lot of just staring up and down, and I guess nonverbal communication. So this
Ricochet seems to got a lot of usage out of this suit this week between laying out Zack Sabre Jr. and then just wearing it straight to Dynamite.
Sure, yeah. We know it was the same suit.
It looked like the same suit.
Yeah, yeah. Well, those are expensive. You know, you want to get your use out of them before you send them to the dry cleaners, I guess. But it looks like Ricochet versus the Hurt Syndicate is going to be a direct feud coming up for Ricochet in the near future. And I'm curious to see.
Ricochet is setting up a lot of stuff. I think he's got like a dozen matches in the hopper. So.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
The conglomeration, they're just hanging out in the ring during all this time. So out come the Learning Tree for our fight without honor. Nigel brings up having one of these matches with Jimmy Rave in Liverpool. Ishii suplexes Jericho through a table early on. Then Keith and Kyle O'Reilly, they leap off the apron, crashing through a table. Big Bill chokeslams Mark Briscoe onto a ladder. All six men are down as we go to picture in picture, and Jericho and Ishii pick up with their chop battle. Then there's a chair duel between Jericho and Briscoe. Big Bill comes in, boots Briscoe, and hits this big sidewalk slam onto Kyle O'Reilly. I thought Big Bill looked very good in his moments in this match. Keith is in with a kendo stick, and then Big Bill and Kyle O'Reilly fight to the back, and Bill goes to chokeslam him off a production box when Kyle applies a guillotine, sending both men through tables.
Well, he choked Big Bill out mid, I guess, standing on a crate. So, of course, they would both fall.
You kind of avoided a chokeslam by kind of like chokeslamming yourself through a table.
I guess better than the alternative where you don't hurt the person delivering the chokeslam to you.
I guess that's it. If we're both going to go down, it's better. We're both going to meet our demise. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So Briscoe hit a J-driller to Jericho, but instead of going for the pin, climbed the ladder and once again hit the froggy bow off the top through the table. And Keith comes in for the save. Ishii takes out Keith, and then Briscoe takes him to the floor, and Ishii is left with Jericho. Sliding D brainbuster, and Ishii pins Jericho in 13 minutes and 38 seconds, pinning the ROH champion.
I thought this was a very good car crash type of match. You know, gave you a lot of very satisfying table breaks, and overall, I think, very entertaining. You know, builds to Ishii versus Jericho.
Right. Mark Briscoe might not be getting another shot at the ROH title. He's graduated out of ROH.
I think we can only hope so.
He has passed on his ROH status to Big Tom.
Yeah, does this feel like it was the end of the Mark Briscoe-Jericho-verse interaction to you?
It felt like Jericho is going to peel off now with Ishii, and that will be... Maybe that's full gear. I don't know if they... I don't see them holding that off for too much longer, like a final battle, for instance. But that looks to be the imminent match. And, yeah, I kind of feel like Briscoe, maybe he's moving on.
Yeah, yeah. We're approaching the Continental Classic, and I'm curious to see like when they make those match announcements and if he enters. I feel like it might be a decent spot for him. But there are a lot of opportunities, a lot of things that you could do with a Mark Briscoe.
The Death Riders are in the back. Moxley explains that Yuta owes nothing to Orange Cassidy just because he slept on your couch or you spotted him some gas money. A guy buys loyalty and doesn't belong to Orange Cassidy or Danielson. He is a soldier under my command. I had high hopes for you, Darby, but you're a disappointment. And then we got John Moxley's rendition of the Birds. There's a time to kill, a time to heal, a time to destroy, and a time to build. What season are we in? So this was, in case this wasn't a very clear, we have officially completed the John Moxley turn.
Oh, very nice. Yeah. Oh, man, I love this dude's promos. I think they're so great. And he makes it look so effortless. Like, I mean, I'm sure plenty of planning might go into this, but like he delivers it with this sort of like just natural charisma about it that makes it feel like it's off the cuff. But when he speaks, it really feels like he's like speaking from a movie script somehow. It's that, like, in the best way, you know, like, I'm not saying he sounds scripted. He sounds like you get sucked into his words as if like he's delivering this like really well-written dialogue as part of a movie scene. It's great. Again, I'm kind of wishing for maybe a little bit more, you know, like clues, you know, like give me a little bit of like sort of a breadcrumb trail about exactly what this philosophy and ideology is that they're trying to sell. But what he's giving us so far has been really well delivered, I think.
Yeah. It was in the middle of this show that, you know, I felt like the Young Bucks angle last week was a pretty significant angle and felt like it needed some kind of focus on this show. Right. I say that, though, on a show that it just feels like there is so many different stories going on that I don't even know if that would be a positive to be putting. It just every single segment, there's some big angle being shot. There is so much information to digest from this 2-hour show. And this was a show that felt like it was at the height of that as opposed to past AEW mm-hmm. shows. So I say all that to say I was like, I felt the Bucks thing was, it was a casualty and maybe the show was better off that we had to drop some things.
It seemed like a pretty clear write-off yesterday. I don't think we'll get an answer about like what exactly, what papers Brandon Cutler was destroying. It just seemed like a psych gag, I think, you know, for that moment. All we have to know is that the Bucks are gone right now. Probably won't be returning until closer to Wrestle Dynasty.
Could be time for Dynasty, yeah, with the Bucks. Yeah. Adam Cole and Malakai Black, their first match together since 2019. And These two men had many matches in NXT together, including a takeover match in Philadelphia on the famed Andrade Johnny Gargano card.
Man, everything revolves around Philadelphia and Pennsylvania, doesn't it?
They get a lot of shows. They get a lot of shows.
They get a lot of attention.
So Black initially is not going for the ankle. And Cole was like, they were giving it like some attention on commentary, but it felt like they were really dialing it back after I think a lot of the criticisms of last week's match and how Cole was perceived in that. What did you think about like the ankle story in this match compared to it being such a major focus last week with Buddy Matthews?
Well, I felt it was more of an artistic choice, John. Like, I mean, for one thing, they've already told the ankle story last week with a very similar, like, you know, Buddy Matthews and Malakai Black are kind of similar characters in that they're just like these silent killers, right? And you've already told last week the story of Cole being vulnerable with the ankle and him not, like, and it was told so well too, you know, with him being insecure about his body afterwards. So if this felt like more of an effort to just tell the next chapter of it, an elevated chapter of it, and they tried to do that by having Black show that he wanted a noble fight with Adam Cole, you know. I think maybe this, on some level, recognizing their long-standing rivalry with each other, and on a bigger level, recognizing that this was some form of significant match for Malakai Black, which we will talk about at the end of
we will go for that. Yeah. This was certainly not built up as a significant match. So Cole tries for the Panama Sunrise, but gets back body dropped. And then Cole ducks the end and manages a destroyer. And then Black responds with a knee strike, gets a two count. Cole does a feint and then kicks out the knee. Black's back with a leg sweep. And then the boom gets cut off with the end. And Black hits it. 1, 2, and Cole kicks out, and the announcers are just stunned. No one kicks out of the end, and I just thought this is like the ultimate kick out for a Malakai Black match, and it was just, I just felt like this should have been like a much bigger reaction, but there was.
Was this the first time someone has kicked out from in AEW, this move? Chat room, let me know. Brian in the chat room, I think you specifically, I'm talking to you, fact check that. Is this the first time somebody has kicked out of the end?
The only one I could think of off the top of my head is if Cody did in one of their early matches, but it didn't come to mind. Regardless, this is an extremely protected move for them. I just did not feel like it was it just didn't feel like the reaction they were expecting for this. And he comes back, hits the Panama Sunrise, and then Cole struggles to get to his feet, and Black can't stand up. Like, his legs have stopped working, and the announcers are trying to explain that
Is it that he couldn't stand up or that he was unwilling to stand up?
Well, the announcers explained he's in shock from the end, and so Black waves him on to... He's going to die on his sword. He's going to eat the boom, and he does, and he is pinned in 12 minutes and 47 seconds. They show Kyle O'Reilly watching in the trainer's room, and then Cole offers his hand. Malachi isn't going to shake his hand. No, he brings it in for a hug. And I have no idea what the status is of Malachi Black, but boy, did this feel like a write-off.
This felt like, yeah, like this felt like this man was about to retire or something. Like, I don't think he is. I'm just saying, all of a sudden, it felt like we were being presented with a Malachi Black. Like, this was the end. This was the end for Malachi Black, you know? Like, this
was also the end of the end as a finisher.
That's it. This felt as much of a goodbye Malachi Black type of match as you could get. And it came out of nowhere. Like, certainly with the finish, it felt like they were doing some version of like a Shawn Michaels type of melodramatic, like, I'm sorry, I love you type of moment. Yeah. But because like there was so little lead up to that type of storytelling, I don't think any of it really registered with the audience. For me, it just kind of confused me. But it wasn't until like all the hugging and the long staying shot of Malachi Black on the ramp that I guess where it really sunk in that, okay, he's probably leaving or something like that.
There was a story here. Again, it just wasn't told. Like, Excalibur mentioned the fact, like, Adam Cole has never beaten this guy one-on-one. And you go, like, their history, like, in the Indies, in NXT, outside of a four-way match in NXT that Black was a part of, Black has beaten him in every one of his matches, but like no one watching this is going to know that off the top of their head. It just felt by the end of this, I felt there was way more on Malachi. This was more about Malachi Black than it was Adam Cole by the end of it. Like, they put so much onto Malachi here. I don't know. It just felt like they were doing like the end of like this long drawn out program for a match that was announced 7 days ago.
Well, this is the middle chapter of an Adam Cole MJF story, isn't it? Like, it's his second match of a series of three that he's supposed to win, and therefore no focus was put on Malachi Black or this match being a significant one for Malachi Black in any sort of way. He was just another obstacle. Yet in the body of the match, we're all of a sudden presented with the final, like what could be the final Malachi Black match in AEW. Just came out of nowhere. Makes you almost wonder if like somehow this was like something they just found out over the past few days and therefore, okay, let's quickly like put this in our match. If it's not something, I'm assuming this is something that they knew was coming. That's just kind of how contracts work, right? If that's the case, I really do think it's a huge missed opportunity that you didn't tell a deeper story with Malachi Black. You can kind of say maybe representative of almost the entire Malachi Black AEW relationship too, because by the end of it, how much does he have to show for it? Is he a bigger star? Like, could you say AEW took full advantage of
having
this guy?
Came in incredibly great with the Cody stuff, and it never reached it just did not work out. I think that's a very safe summation of this run.
And why didn't he reach his potential here?
I don't know, but it maybe there were forces that just wanted it to fade to black.
Okay,
well,
all right.
And we state that all like without having clear.
Yeah, he might just show up on Collision. So we know the House of Black are supposed to be in this tag team thing with Private Party, this tag team tournament.
I assume that's going to be Matthews and Brody King anyway. But they only announced it as House of Black. But yes. And then Cole gets on the mic and says Black is one of the best he has ever fought and thanks him. And then changes his focus to MJF, states, I need one more win. And then Roddy needs one more win. And you never said what would happen if both of us...
No. Roderick Strong needs two more wins.
Roderick needs two more wins. You're right. Yeah. And Cole says, you never said what would happen if each of us win all three. It's like, I was very clear on the fact that it was said the first one to win three.
Yeah.
Was that not how it was stated? So now it's just whoever
it was stated, but I think what MJF meant was, okay, you're each going to have three matches. Whoever wins three straight first, regardless of match order, regardless of who gets the matches first, wins or gets the title shot.
So MJF, through his own idea, is going to end up putting himself against two people that want to destroy him.
Oh, he didn't see it coming. He didn't think they could win three matches each.
Cole makes it clear. He went to Tony Khan, and if both of them win all three matches, it will be a triple threat match. And, you know, we had been thinking that, okay, they're both 2-0, and then MJF gets to say match three. It's Adam Cole versus Roderick Strong. But it looks like they are not going that direction, because next week it will be Adam Cole against Konosuke Takeshita. And they're very heavily hinting now at a triple threat match, which I don't know why they're even entertaining this. I think it only brings down the interest in this, but there you have it.
Right, yeah.
Unless there's some angle for Roderick to lose at the end. But, I mean, man, does this thing seem way overly complicated.
Yeah.
To get to this.
And, like, MJF doing these constant cutaways to his lair.
Which are all shot in one day. Yeah, he's in the same clothes.
I mean, it's very clear that, like, yeah, like, he's probably off filming a movie or something and therefore, like, can't be around for this. And therefore, you need to somehow tell this story without MJF being present. And they've devised this series of three trial match thing. I am assuming at the end of all this, we're going to be pivoting to a Roddy versus Adam Cole, like, feud, right? So they need to be building that at the same time that they're trying to finish MJF versus Cole as well. Could it have been cleared up a little bit more? I mean, maybe, but I think they're also trying to serve so many masters at the same time.
The only thing that could have made this better would be if Cole says, and one more thing, let's go back to the devil thing. I want to explain this one more time.
Yeah, one more explanation. Yeah.
I don't think everyone gets it, okay? You've got to fight evil with evil. I'm not evil. I incorporated evil to defeat evil before that evil showed his evil.
That's great. Okay, that brings up something interesting, though, because last week, remember the very surprising Buddy Matthews babyface reaction to what I've kind of sensed was a bit more of a heelish reaction to Adam Cole. Do you think that's still a threat? Do you think there's a threat that this audience, whenever this match happens between MJF and Cole, will be cheering MJF over Adam Cole?
Yes, I think that's very possible. They're in New Jersey, which is, you know, not... I remember us when we went to Full Gear 2 years ago, and MJF, I mean, granted, at that point in time, I think he was overall much more being embraced by the audience. But I think you could get a total pro MJF crowd in that part of the country. And the way this story has been mangled, and that MJF, you have not given this guy any kind of clear reason to boo this man. Yes, I think that's very possible.
It would be the greatest thing if at the end of all of this, the crowd just boos Adam Cole and cheers MJF anyway.
Well, who knows?
Yeah.
MJF reacts on his movie set, and he calls and tells someone to pay a visit. And this person was very quick to respond.
Yeah.
Renee interviews Jay White, who is attacked by Hangman Page, and they fight into the arena, and White's ankle gets locked in the guardrail, and he's trapped, and Hangman grabs a chair. When Juice runs out, White frees himself, and Page takes off through the crowd. White says he's going to embarrass Hangman at Full Gear, and that you've never been ahead of me, you never will, and your leg will be your downfall, and perhaps I'll be the first one to make you tap out.
Yes. So, yeah, giving us a specific injury target here with Hangman Page. You know, speaking of, like, heel babyface dynamics, I mean, there were a lot of Hangman Page cheers tonight. I think he's supposed to be the heel in this one. because
it's choose your own adventure in AEW.
Jay White certainly is the babyface. But yeah, at this point, maybe it's just, this is modern wrestling, okay? Like, you cheer and boo for whoever you want as long as you care. Seems like both characters are over enough that the audience does give a shit about who wins or who loses. But I find the dynamics interesting because Paige is at such a cool heel type of level. But the audience is reacting well to Jay White, though, I would say.
And then we go to Renee with Chris Statlander.
Oh, boy. Jeez. We're getting a trifecta here. Confusing characters. All right.
So Renee announces that Chris is facing Mercedes Moné at the pay-per-view at Full Gear for the TBS title. Cool. Good luck, Chris. So Chris walks off. And then we hear a car screech. And Renee screams for help. And we cut to an SUV that has narrowly missed Statlander and driven into a guardrail. Camille is behind. It's so subtle, this hit and run as we're live broadcast here. And Camille is behind the wheel. Mercedes calls her stupid because she didn't hit the target. So Chris then attacks the two assailants and slams a door onto Camille's arm and then lifts and drops Mercedes onto the hood of a car. This was just a random 2-minute angle in the middle of this 2+ hour show. This was total cartoon, everything I don't want on this show. I hated this.
Yeah, this was pretty bad. I would say vehicular homicide angles in pro wrestling typically don't turn out all that great. Sometimes they're the stuff of legend, but rarely are they like the things that we would classify as like, wow, that was good pro wrestling TV. And this was certainly more of that category. I think everything that Moné has been involved in, unfortunately, has just been a pretty low quality. And I'd never thought,
I don't know if there's any three individuals that could have made this work. This was an awful idea.
I never would have suggested a hit and run to be the remedy for, you know,
a botched hit and run too at that. Like, this is just such a nothing. This is why you do big angles and no one cares about them, because you do stuff like this. That is just, how can you possibly take the body of this show seriously when you're doing this kind of stuff? Like, we worry about the invisible camera, and this passes the logic gap for us.
I mean, to be fair, we did have a man burn another man's house down, okay? Like, that's sort of the bar. We've had people choke each other out with plastic bags, you know? We've kind of defeated that, maybe, the invisible camera a while ago. But it seems like the dynamic now between Moné and Camille is that Camille is a fuck-up, okay? She couldn't beat Statlander. She couldn't commit a hit-and-run as instructed. So that we're supposed to, I guess, feel sorry for Camille in some ways now.
I wish that's how they kicked off Bill Goldberg's career. They should have made him like this fuck up that just like slips in the back, or he's, you know,
Camille is not the performer of the Bill Goldberg though.
Yeah. It's, I don't know about Camille. I don't know.
But this has just not been good. I think the saving grace will be the match itself. You know, Statlander versus Moné in ring should deliver good quality. But it's all this shit that's just surrounding both of their characters that unfortunately has taken this down some
awful segment.
Support for this post-wrestling podcast comes from those of you who have picked up our merch over at Chopped Tees. T-shirts, hoodies, sweatshirts, and hats from post-wrestling and our network of shows, including the NWA Podcast, Poison Rana, The Long and Winding Royal Road, WrestleNomics, and MC Later. Free shipping to almost anywhere in the entire world. No minimum spend required. That's chopped-tees.com/post-wrestling.
Christian Cage comes out with the Patriarchy and officially welcomes Kip Sabian into the Patriarchy, because he, like you, the people, is a fatherless loser who is just looking for direction. And he shows a clip from last month when Kip came out and ripped away the contract from Christian, preventing him from cashing in. And then Christian ran to the back, seeing Claudio and Pac, and he now realizes Kip was helping him, because if he tried to cash in, the Death Riders would have run in and prevented him from winning.
So now, do you believe that when they did that, that was supposed to be the payoff for this moment?
Probably not, but it's plausible enough to patch this together.
So I wonder, because if it wasn't that, then I wonder what the payoff was supposed to be. Did they have a better payoff at the end of this?
Why did he, after that, Matt, after preventing the title shot, why did he distract Cage from delivering the spear? What was that?
Twice. Why did
maybe
he
was
that?
Worried, you know, that can cause neck damage, you know, to the person delivering it. I don't want you to injure yourself.
Yeah, did I buy the explanation? You know, a little bit shaky for me, but okay, like, good enough, I guess.
So then Cage explains that you've done more for me than any of my other sons have ever done. So it feels like in Luchasaurus's absence, they're just moving this angle onto Nick Wayne. Now Nick Wayne is the forgotten son.
Right, yeah.
Not well, Steve Macklin.
This is, I guess, his style of parenting, John, okay? To always make one son jealous of the other by showing how disappointed you are by one of them so that they might be able to reach their potential. So clearly this is, yeah, it's what they're doing. But you know what? I think it's a good role for Wayne. You know, he's been in this stable for quite a while now. He needs some evolution in his role as a character. And doing this, making him the disappointing son, gives him that sort of like babyface teasing that Luchasaurus was able to enjoy for many months. And I think Nick Wayne is almost ready at this point to break out of this group.
Real sign in the front row?
I came to see Kip Sabian. I would say real, maybe supported by maybe Kip Sabian's parents. Or sorry, that's Christian now. Another family member.
So Hook is out because this was supposed to be a face-to-face. And Cage is left to explain himself. Why did you attack my father? So this was quite the... this was quite the argument that Cage made for himself. He says, I need a son like you. And I didn't, that wasn't a beatdown that we gave you. I just wanted to see if you could be disciplined. And that's why we had to do that. And I had to make sure that you didn't have any other voices inside your head. That's why I took out your father. And says, Taz is a legend in this business. If you don't believe me, just ask him. He says that Taz, when I attacked him, he saw my face. This is like the first time we've had an attack where they've acknowledged that the person being attacked had to have seen the attacker. So why did Taz not tell you that? And instead you had to seek out security footage and says, I can take you to new heights. Taz was the face of an outlaw promotion, a big fish.
So he said specifically, Taz never told you that I attacked him. Christian says because Taz believes that Christian would be a better teacher for Hook than Taz.
So if Taz had told him, hey, son, Christian murdered me on television, that would send Hook to be under the spell of Christian. Wouldn't that...
No. If he didn't tell him...
He didn't tell him. That's the story. He did not tell him. Hook had to go find this out for himself.
Which Christian uses as proof that Taz believes that Christian would be a better parent to Hook than Taz would.
How?
I don't know, man. It's I wouldn't even say it's heel logic. It's
not any logic. There's no.
Realistically, why wouldn't Taz tell Cook? Why wouldn't he if he knew?
That would that not prevent him? That would give him a grudge against Christian, would it not?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Which happened anyway as a result of this.
Yeah. I don't know what's going on. So then he just buries ECW here. I guess this was them getting out their grief of the head-to-head, calling it Taz was a big fish in a little pond. And then he made it to the big time where he buckled under the pressure, under the bright lights. So in one instance, burying ECW, but then boy, do we make WWE the big leagues. And he hid behind the announcer's desk and asks, do you want to be an announcer like your dad or a revered champion like me? And then Christian stops and says, I should have really laid it in more on Taz because it seems like this crowd doesn't even care if Taz is alive because this crowd was not reacting to anything here and says, I wish your father was dead, Hook. So Hook then charges the ring, gets the red rum on Christian, but the security stops him. So Hook destroys security. A totally illogical story, but it's a story.
Yeah, I thought overall, like, everything attached to the patriarchy in this segment was way too convoluted, like starting with the Kip Sabian thing to his explanation of how it's fine, like, it's perfectly fine to have, like, Christian be the one attack Taz, but then to explain that Taz saw me but chose not to tell you, Hook, because of this reason.
The exposition they get into to, like, number one is that, like, we are nitpicking something that I am sure there are many fans that are not giving it any level of thought. But at that same time, I think also have no level of engagement in the story either.
Yes.
So, I mean, to me,
I'll tell you my reaction, John, okay, coming off of this segment, okay? Because I watch it and I'm like, okay, you know, that's it. I don't really, like, all of what we've been talking about, I haven't even really noted. It's only through, like, this sort of dissection and me like, walking through my thought process of why do I feel so meh about this? That tells me why I feel so meh about this, you know?
I think there are so many stories going on, and so many of them are reflective of this, where they feel so scattered. I think that they need to pick out some just simple stories. Like, okay, we've got our pay-per-view through November, whenever Full Gear is. Let us just have some simple build to World's End. It's a 5-week build to that next pay-per-view. Not everything has to be this long, weaving road that has all these contradictions that we have to shore up, all of these logic gaps. It just feels as though, like, the Elite story this year with Tony Khan, I think, like, that was indicative of just a story gone awry. But you also have these other little, like, forest fires, I'm going to call them. And I just think a lot of the storytelling leaves a lot to be desired among these, like, the Cole MJF stuff. Like, we spent 2 weeks trying to retcon this thing. It's like, let's just simplify this. We don't have to throw in Roderick and Undisputed Kingdom, and we got to go through this process. I understand there's handicaps. MJF isn't around. We have to keep Cole in this story without his dance partner. But they just feel like they create these hurdles for themselves that they have to jump over, and they are tripping over themselves in so many of these stories. This was the latest one. Then they showed highlights of Brian Cage and Lance Archer, who they note are undefeated, not in this tag tournament. And then Marvez catches up with Don Callis, and this man walks in with cash and the Dynamite Dozen ring. He has been sent on behalf of MJF. How do we know this? He left him a voicemail. So MJF called this guy, talked to him, and then called him again to leave this voicemail informing Don Callis. That's a lot of work this guy's doing on his movie set. So this guy played this, and Don Callis took the money, took the ring, and I guess he is also now going after Adam Cole. So
yeah, another surrogate for MJF.
Yes. I mean, at least we do have this connection with Takeshita for next week. So that part aligns.
Right, it does, yeah. But, I mean, is this the debut of a new character? You know, is this a new permanent character that's now, like, MJF's
bodyguard? He's MJF's...
his fixer?
I guess, yeah.
Okay, yeah. Interesting. I have no idea who this person is, but he looks like a wrestler.
He was identified by Alex Marvez as, who are you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Penelope Ford against Jamie Hayter. This was one match. This was promoted for, like, several weeks. And, you know, I thought they had, like, a fine match for the time they had. It was by far the shortest on the show. Ford missed a moonsault off the top. So Ford then gets hit with a sliding boot and then a brainbuster. Ford then does the Matrix to avoid a lariat into a cutter for a two count. And then Ford lifts her up onto her shoulders. Hayter counters into Haterade. 438, Jamie Hayter gets the win. And they really tried to promote Haterade as, like, this move that it can come out of nowhere and it puts you down instantly. But short, but fine.
It was pretty quick, I guess, for a match that was maybe promoted for such a long time in comparison maybe to some of the other matches on the show. I thought Penelope Ford looked really good in this match. I thought she showed really improved aggression in all of her moves, which to me is, like, one of the things that maybe makes certain talents stand out in this women's division. Certainly something that makes Jamie Hayter stand out in this division. The Matrix move to the cutter was very well timed, including, I think, how close the lariat was to her dodging it. So maybe the best I've seen that spot done. So yeah, like, if this was a quick, audition, I suppose you could say, for Penelope Ford to show that she's capable of like something more. I thought she looked impressive here.
You know what I liked about this match, Wei, in the last 2 weeks? All the twists and turns that this feud had. It had Penelope Ford coming back after like 2 years away. She said, "I don't care about your return, Jamie Hayter. You didn't have to work as hard as I did." Jamie Hayter said, "Fuck you. I've worked really hard. Let's fight."
Yeah, but
that was the story.
Who got hit by the car, though? Okay.
Who swerved and missed? Who screwed up the hit and run? Yeah. Mina Shirakawa. We had a video. She is coming next week. And then I was like, oh, no. I see a QR code. Do I go down the rabbit hole? This, it actually gave us something. We go to a Where in the World is Toni Storm video ever since disappearing after Wembley. And then she goes and lists off all the appearances she has made. The on sale in Australia, going to Japan for Stardom, having the affair with Stan Hansen, which has now made it onto television. Well, kind of by proxy. And going to CMLL where she faced La Catalina. So where will she turn up next? And I guess they're teasing it coming up soon.
They must be, if like they're trying to sneak this QR code in, right? You know? So yeah, really well done video. I find it interesting how it said it was uploaded 13 days ago. So I guess they had this thing wet ready and was just kind of, you know, waiting for this to
debut. Was it unlisted?
Yeah, I'm assuming. Yeah.
Well, I'm glad they remembered to unlist it. That would have been a great QR code.
Oh, even better, wouldn't it? If it was unlisted.
Then we had...
Maybe it's still unlisted. I don't know. I'm not sure.
Then we had a feature on Kazuchika Okada. Has comments from Jim Ross stating he's top five in the world. And states... The voiceover notes that if he wins this year's Continental Classic, he could achieve a rare feat. He could tie Masahiro Chono for the most major tournament wins. Because in pro wrestling, there are two tournaments that exist. It is the G1 and the Continental Classic. Chono has won 5 G1s. Okada's won 4. He's not going to win another G1. So now his G1s are credits that go towards the Continental Classic. And then, after explaining Chono's dominance in the G1, we cut to Okada. Who is Chono? He's not an international star like Okada. I am Japan's greatest export. And they announced that Okada will defend his crown in the Continental Classic this year. Mm. I don't know where my head was at, but after some of these angles on this show, by the end of this video, Wei, was there a part of me that wants Okada and Chono? Yes, there is. Yes, there is. Okay. I don't care if it's got to be 2 minutes. I was sold on this match that they probably didn't mean to sell me, but I bought it.
If Chono can come back for a match with the great Muda, okay, the man can work a tournament. Okay. Like he can, you put him through a round robin in several, like, you know, Yano style matches. I'm sure Chono could do it. Okay. Defend your crown,
Mr.
Chono.
December.
Exactly. There you go. Yes, perfect. This has to be leading to some interaction, right, between Masahiro Chono and Kazuchika Okada. I don't think they would just do this for no reason.
I wonder if they could do... It would be interesting if they made the finals of the Continental Classic at one of the Dome shows. And there you could have Chono ringside.
You like think AEW would have the finals of their tournament at... And a New Japan show? Maybe Dynasty. Maybe.
Dynasty. Yeah. I mean, it's last year it was World's End, right? That it concluded at. So
right, which was just happening again this year.
Yes. So those are your destination spots. If it's Okada, I wouldn't rule it out.
But they're
making this like his like story is tying Chono. Like that is his what he is like
it's
chasing.
His Ric Flair record that he's chasing. Yeah.
To tie it, not surpass.
To tie it, right. Yeah. Okay. Is it taking very creative liberties somehow, like equating the Continental Classic to the G1 record and folding those two lineages in to the same record? Yes. But I in pro wrestling storytelling, I don't mind it. I think you could take those liberties from time to time. And if the payoff at the end is having some sort of like, you know, Chono interaction with Okada, I think it gives him a storyline that is attractive.
Does his New Japan Cup wins count? Because that puts him over.
So Excalibur said major pro wrestling major.
Okay, New Japan Cup is minor. Yes.
Okay. Yeah, that's the minor leagues. I'm guessing he means round robin. Is that what it means? And sure. And are
they,
we including
that was like not the wording, but they just said major tournament.
So then, what about like? Can we fact check this? Okay, like has there been somebody who's won like the N1 more often than Chono?
No, there haven't even been that many N1s. So no.
Okay, then there you go.
Kyle Fletcher and Kenosuke Takeshita was next out, awaiting Ricochet and his mystery partner. Ricochet comes out, and he explains that his partner's contract with Don Callis expired in October, and he's pissed off because he feels forgotten. This oversight, and out comes powerhouse Hobbs, who finds himself in the same spot that Dwayne Johnson did that year WWE, his contract expired. So something with a guy. This is what happened with Dwayne Johnson in WWE in 2004. At the end of the year, his contract lapsed and no one noticed it.
Okay, and what it was did that to result be a, in?
He was not under contract, briefly.
Oh, okay.
And no one noticed it. So anyway, this is what happens to guys named Hobbs and contracts that have an expiration that no one realizes. So Hobbs looked great coming out here, and I thought he looked very good in the match, as I thought these two had great chemistry together as a team.
I like this team a lot. Together, you know, like it's a great big man. Ricochet is not that small these days, but like a big man, less big man dynamic. You have a high flyer and just a great like power base. And I'm curious to see like character wise what sort of chemistry they might have. But in ring, they certainly have something. Yeah.
Early on, Ricochet moonsaults off of Hobbs' shoulders to both on the floor. And then they take over after Fletcher spikes Ricochet with a DDT for the advantage. I'm sure this was in picture-in-picture, but throughout the night, Nigel was like handing these softballs to Tony Schiavone, and Schiavone would just give him nothing in response. There was one in this match where he talks about Ricochet has stolen Will Ospreay's move, referring to the hidden blade. And Schiavone's like, how do you steal someone's move? Did Ospreay come up with that move? And Nigel's trying to be the heel here to get the story going. And Excalibur like pipes in. He's like, oh, that's Ricochet's version of the hidden blade. It's called the spirit gun. And this was actually important because this was literally the finish of the match, was using this move as his finisher, not the vertigo. Anyway, Adam Cole is watching, and this is where they announce he'll face Takeshita next week. Hobbs gets the hot tag, and this is when the crowd awakened. And he comes in, and him and Takeshita just go at it. There's this giant lariat, and then Fletcher's in with a last ride sit-out powerbomb to Ricochet. The Takeshita and Fletcher hit double running boots together, and then Ricochet hits a counter with a Rana off the turnbuckle. We see a wheelbarrow to Ricochet, and he flips over, lands on his feet, tries for the poison Rana, but Takeshita deadlifts him up on the shoulders for a doomsday device, and then Hobbs takes out Fletcher. Ricochet fights back. There's a dragon Rana for a two count. A shooting star on Takeshita. He kicks out, so he's got to dig deep. It's time for the spirit gun. And he hits him with the spirit gun and pins the international champion, Kenosuke Takeshita. And there are your winners, Ricochet and Hobbs. Very good match. Hobbs.
Very good match. Yeah, yeah. Good showing for powerhouse Hobbs. I hope he sticks with Ricochet as a tag team. They have, again, a great dynamic. And Fletcher and Takeshita are already a really great team, aren't they?
Fletcher continues to be amazing. Such a breakout. He has done outstanding in these last couple of months. Like, I look forward to seeing this guy each week, and I think he has really stepped up in this role that he's been given.
Yeah, like if you have to like select a new, there are a lot of like, so we might kind of like criticize a lot of the storytelling on the show, but I think something that is has been great about AEW in its current existence is that there's a very clear second level, second tier of guys that are making their way up. There's very clear ascension from you know, people in the mid card that are looking to break through to that top end, and Fletcher is among the top of that class. So a big closing angle here.
Fletcher continues the attack on Ricochet with a chair when Mark Davis comes out, the best dressed man in pro wrestling, putting the Hurt Syndicate to shame. And he shoves Kyle Fletcher to the ground when Lance Archer and Brian Cage come in to attack. Out comes Adam Cole. He starts fighting with Takeshita in the aisle. And then Fletcher gets the screwdriver, and he's ready to screw Mark Davis when Will Ospreay makes his return, and this place goes nuts for Ospreay. Fletcher sold this. He can't believe the man's alive. And out comes Ospreay, and along with Hobbs, Davis, and Ricochet, they clear the ring. They're teasing like this unbelievable eight-man that I hope we get on Collision. And Fletcher avoids the Hidden Blade at the end. And that's how we finished off the show with and the announcements for Collision with the Death Riders against Briscoe, Kyle O'Reilly, and Ishii for the Trios belts, and mainly Cole and Takeshita for next week's Dynamite.
Mm-hmm. So Fletcher looks like he's ready to come back, and I'm looking forward to the, Yes, Davis. And I think putting him in this like mini stable with a Ricochet and a Hobbs and an Ospreay, at least temporarily, is a great way to give him some added focus while like maybe not necessarily relying on him just for a whole singles match. You're just wanting to reintroduce him to the audience at this point. And I look forward to that eight man, whatever that's happening. And again, great role for Powerhouse Hobbs at this point.
Pros and cons of tonight's show. I thought the show had a really strong ending to it. I really enjoyed this tag match at the end. Wrestling-wise on the show, I didn't have too many complaints. I thought the fight without honor was very strong. I was enjoying the opening tag match. You had like the finish that I thought was more so a way out of the match rather than something that really enhanced the story. But yeah, wrestling-wise, this was not my complaint on the show. But some of like the stories, I just feel like there's way too many of them. That number one, it's the volume of stories mm-hmm. that I feel are going on that is overload. And several of them, I just feel are... they just feel like they are trying to, they do not compute, I think, to the average person that is watching this and the details they're trying to explain, that there's holes in a lot of these, and that car angle, if I cannot stress one thing from this show, that was just a dreadful, dreadful, like 2 minutes of AEW programming. That it's just the kind of thing that I just, at its core, is something they should not be putting on their programming.
That felt like an angle straight from like what 2008 WWE, you know, like Vince loves his like vehicular manslaughter types of angles, and that felt like directly ripped from that era, in quality even. In terms of like what wasn't so great, I think the MJF Adam Cole story continues to be maybe a little bit too complicated for its own good. The patriarchy stuff I was not a fan of at all on this particular show, but the good on the show, I think there's still a lot of really great spots. The death the Death Rider stuff with Orange Cassidy, I think, is really strong. I Moxley continues to be like a fantastic promo. I do wish like they would give us a little bit more about, you know, exactly what they're fighting for. But in terms of tone, in terms of just interest, you're getting some of the best stuff on the show through those guys. Hurt Syndicate, great debut for them. It seems like they're trying to line up with Ricochet right now, doing some sort of feud, and Hobbs, I guess you could expect to be attached to that now as well.
And a simple setup with Swerve for the pay-per-view. So, no, there was good stuff on this show, but I think you can see a lot of the central issues that I think are, like, you can see why some of these stories are not landing with people. And there's just so many angles that are being shot. And it's like when you're, like, actively, like, taking notes on this show, like, just the amount of details and angles, like by the end of the show, like there's no way people are processing all this that you are cramming into these 2 hours.
And we'll find out soon, I'm sure, about what exactly the status is of Malakai Black in AEW.
All right. We've spoken enough. So it is time to hand it over to you, and we will take any super chats and feedback here on the forum with thoughts on tonight's show. And maybe people will chime in on NXT as well. Maybe not.
Let's go to forum.postwrestling.com, see what people have to say.
We start things off with Andrew from Cape Breton. I like the show tonight. It was a good distraction. I'm annoyed by the constant DQs in Death Rider matches, and I hope that doesn't become a habit with them. All the matches were solid and seemed to get a good reaction from the crowd, but something seemed off about the Adam Cole Malakai Black match. It wasn't what I was expecting as far as in-ring goes, and especially didn't compare well to the other matches on the night. It was also good to see Powerhouse Hobbs back. A shame that apparently Camille is as good of a driver as she is a wrestler. Overall, it was a good show tonight.
Oh, man. Definitely the Cole Black match was weird, and maybe for reasons we'll find out later. Let's go to Brian in New Jersey, where at least some good people were elected. Nice to have some fun wrestling tonight to ignore the shitty news from last night. I'll watch NXT 2300.
Was that last night? Shit.
I think it was, yes.
You missed it? Yeah, don't tell me.
Oh, don't go on Twitter. Nice to have some fun wrestling tonight to ignore the shitty news from last night. I'll watch NXT 2300 later, as I wasn't up paying $75. Up for paying $75 to see it live. What? Why would he have to do that?
At the NXT show.
Got it. Because he lives there. Yes. Dynamite was worth my evening, capped off by a great return for Hobbs and a really good tag match overall. Ospreay, Ricochet, Hobbs, and Davis in the ring at the end, looking like a heck of a squad to take on the Don Callis family in a future 8-man. Good wrestling overall in this episode. I guess I should have expected the non-finish in the other big tag match given its placement, so I thought it was a bummer end to that otherwise hot match. Nice to know that Moxley's career is officially called the Death Riders by the... Okay, Moxley's stable is officially called the Death Riders. All right. Julia Hart has mentioned she's just waiting on a call to return. Do you see her getting involved in the Women's World title picture or back in the TBS title picture?
Sure. There's a lot of people coming back. There's a lot of people to manage. And I mean, you have two shows. I mean, that's...
And you have two heel champions that I think, like, Julia Hart would pair well with. I would assume she would come back as a babyface at this point. So she could take on Monet. She could take on... Mariah May as well.
Next is Jordan from the Bronx. This was a fun episode and a much-needed escape from current events. I love seeing the Hurt Syndicate getting a chance to present themselves in front of a live crowd. Their song is dope, and they look like $1 million. I'm wondering who they will add to their ranks. I originally thought Hobbs, but he returned as an ally of Ricochet. Seems like Camille's presentation has soured in the last month. Her matches have not been good, and now her thing is being incompetent. I don't think it's a good thing to continue having Camille look inferior in this Statlander-Mercedes feud. Is Malakai Black leaving, taking a break? I know that his place in the company has always been questioned, but the match and post-match felt like he was done. If so, that would be disappointing, because I really liked him and the House of Black, despite their inconsistent pushes. I mean, we can't say for certain, but that I can't imagine too many people watching that didn't draw the same conclusion that at minimum there it seemed to be a hiatus and perhaps permanent, but... We don't know for sure.
We'll see. We'll find out. Yeah, about Camille, I wonder if this is like a pivot for her character, maybe, or if this was just something they've always thought was like a good idea. Like, how much of the pivot to now her being an incompetent bodyguard came as a result of what I think has been like pretty poorly received in-ring performances?
Well, I think the quick fix is that, you know, it's the turn on Mercedes, which...
Yeah.
I just don't think you've built that up enough that should be something really big that's, you know, teased over time and time. But I don't think you've never really established her as this big threat. This has been a pretty short relationship. And for her to turn on Mercedes, it's just like it's a program. I don't know if it's a real compelling one.
No, not yet. My turn.
Yes.
We go to Cody from Maine in Manchester, who went to the show, I guess. A few notes on crowd reactions, which I hope translated well, as the crowd was very lively. Okay, so prove, John, that if you're in the crowd, maybe it sounded different. As expected, the Hurt Syndicate were incredibly over. Jericho, for all the complaints, still generates a significant reaction. And then there's Adam Cole, which saw the crowd split 50-50 once again. It's not looking like they'll get the desired reaction when he and MJF are finally in the ring together. Also, so he's going to turn heel again. Awesome. Also, it may have only felt that way live, but it really looked like they were giving Malakai his flowers. Noah came across like that on TV too. He still has time. Again, we'll find all of that out, I'm sure, in over the next 24 hours. I really like them hyping up Okada as a tournament expert. It should make for a great moment for whoever defeats him. And lastly, a main event with nearly all members being guys that the company had built up. Hobbs' return being treated like a big deal was great to see, and they built to Ospreay's appearance really well. I look forward to listening to the show on my drive home tomorrow. All right, hope you had
all right, well, thanks for the live report, Cody. We do appreciate it. All right, thanks for everyone's feedback. I think that covered a lot of ground on this particular edition of Dynamite. I'm going to be back on Thursday with Brandon Thurston, so tune in, special Thursday edition at 1 Eastern on the Post Wrestling YouTube channel, and you can hear Wei Ting once again Friday night on Rewind to SmackDown, as the two of us will be going live as the Bloodline get together. Well, the old Bloodline. They're going to have a conference in the ring. What could go wrong?
A family meeting. Emergency family meeting on Friday.
Yeah, on national television. So that's coming up on Friday. Collision Course this Saturday. So check out all of that, and you can keep up to date at postwrestling.com. So thanks to everyone for tuning in, and we will speak with you later this week.